faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision is built by Christians to help you steward what God's given you. Track your spending, saving and giving in one place. Join the waitlist now at provision.money and get your first month free. That's provision.money.
Premier Podcast.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, hello and welcome along to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. This is the weekly show which brings you an interesting interview with a Christian in some walk of faith and life. I'm brought to you, as usual, in association with Premier Christianity magazine, where you can find more interviews with people from all walks of life. Find your free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/free sample. Well, today I'm talking to Brian Brodersen, who's the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa in California, the church which launched the Calvary Chapel network of churches in the USA and across the world under the leadership of Chuck Smith, who passed away in 2013. Well, Brian, who happens to be the son-in-law of Chuck, has been involved in church leadership and planting himself since soon after his conversion himself as a young surfer dude in 1983. That included planting and leading Calvary Chapel Westminster in London for several years, and establishing Creation Fest, which is an outreach festival that takes place in the West Country and Scotland each summer. Brian's daily Bible teaching program, Back to Basics, is broadcast on stations around the world, including here on Premier Christian Radio. So welcome along to the program, Brian.
Great to be here, Justin.
You'll be a familiar voice to many Premier Christian Radio listeners, but perhaps those on podcast may not be so familiar who are listening that way to The Profile today. You came to the UK not long after Premier Christian Radio had just got going, really, didn't you?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think my first connection with Premier was in 1995, and I think maybe just a year or two you guys had.
Well, we started in 95, so that 95? Would have been right when we began.
Okay, yeah, I got it on the ground level. Yes, I did. You know, I came and there was this plan to come and do a church plant. And I had done radio in the U.S. for years. And so a mutual friend was friends with, you would probably remember, David Herron. Mm. And so got me in touch with David. We had a conversation. I told him I had a radio program. And the next thing I knew, we were broadcasting with you. Yeah, back in 95.
David Herron was for a number of years the chairman of Premier Christian Radio. And so your program has been broadcasting more or less ever since then, Back to Basics, which is essentially your preaching kind of segmented into a kind of radio format.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not just broadcast here in the UK either, is it?
It's broadcast on various
stations.
Yeah, now, of course, with the internet, it's worldwide, but we're on a number of stations throughout the US as well.
I want to talk to you about Calvary Chapel, obviously, about your role there, about the history. But let's start with your history, first of all. You haven't always been a Christian. So tell us about growing up and what the environment was.
Yeah, I grew up in the Southern California surf culture, which if people don't know what that is, it's kind of a very hedonistic type of a lifestyle. And it was back in those days, the 70s, pretty much the 70s. It was kind of, sex, drugs, rock and roll, and of course, surf was at the top of the list, actually. Yeah. So grew up in that kind of environment, just living, the party life and all of that. And
did you have any kind of Christian influences growing up?
You know, I was raised as a Roman Catholic,
right?
But it was fairly early on that I jettisoned that, and just decided who needs that, So. By the time I came around to having some kind of interest in the things of God, I was pretty far removed from any kind of a church experience.
How did you get into the surfing lifestyle?
The surfing lifestyle. I think I was 12 or 13 years old, and surfing was just a cool thing, So if you would see you know, maybe a movie with surfers in it or whatever. And of course they had all the cute girls. So you're like, man, I want to be one of those, you know? So I think at the ripe old age of 12, I got myself a surfboard and started surfing.
You were like a beach boy.
Yeah, exactly.
That was the kind of vibe.
Yeah. That's it.
And did you envisage that as possibly even a career as a kind of?
No, back in those days, you know, nowadays, of course, professional surfing is huge all over the world. People make, you know, multi-millions of dollars being professional surfers. We were sole surfers in those days. Yeah. It was actually before the era of professional surfing, really. Yeah. I mean, there were a handful of guys that did, you know, two sort of contests a year, one at Waimea Bay with 30-foot waves and one at Pipeline with 25-foot waves. That was about the extent of it.
I mean, would you have said you were pretty good?
Well,
does it depend? I want to be
as modest as I can here. Yeah, yeah. People would say I was a good surfer. I wasn't a great surfer, but I was a good surfer.
Well, I'm barely able to stand up the few times I've tried it. So anyone who can do that is good in my book. But I mean, okay. So you were living this surfer lifestyle, and that went with it, as you say, kind of. The lifestyle involved sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah.
So what was someone involved in that lifestyle? How did they eventually bump into Christ?
Well, you know, at the time, this whole Jesus people thing was kind of going on. It's sort of right around me. And I did my best to avoid it. I didn't, you know, there were hippies, and I didn't really like hippies. I wasn't a hippie. I didn't want to be a hippie. I was a little younger than most hippies anyway. So they sort of freaked me out. And I thought somehow in my juvenile way of thinking back then, I just somehow thought that, well, you know, to be a Jesus person, you got to be a hippie. And I kind of liked the Jesus message, but I didn't like the hippie part of it. So I did my best to stay away, you know. And back in those days, there was a big tent set up at Calvary Chapel, and everybody talked about the tent, and everybody and their brother tried to get me to go to the tent. And I thought, I got a good Catholic church in town. If I want to go to church, that's where I'm going. I'm not going to a tent. So I did my best to stay away.
I mean, this kind of introduces us to the whole phenomenon that was the Calvary Chapel movement and the Jesus People movement of the 60s and 70s.
Right.
And at the epicenter of that was Chuck Smith and this church that he had suddenly experienced this explosion of evangelism and conversion as all these kind of folks from the kind of 60s hippie era started to find Christ, basically, and kind of swapped the psychedelic drugs for the Holy Spirit thing.
Yeah.
So you obviously kind of were vaguely aware of this situation. Obviously, since then, you've learned a lot more, I imagine, about how that all happened and why it happened.
Yeah. Yeah, and now, you know, with hindsight, I think everybody recognizes that was a revival, really, you know, an outpouring, an awakening, whatever you want to call it. It was really extraordinary because, you know, I grew up my whole life in Southern California, and like I said, you know, having a Roman Catholic background, moving away from that early on, church, Jesus, the gospel, that was the farthest thing from anybody's mind. But then suddenly, there's all these people walking around talking about Jesus, And you know, I had no, you know, context to put it in back then. I just, and Jesus Freaks was the label that everybody gave those people because it just seemed like a really freaky thing.
And in a way, it kind of it had elements of the sort of hippie lifestyle in as much as people were quite often setting up communes to kind of go back to that kind of early church living kind of way of doing things. It was all about the guitars and the influx, the explosion really of a new kind of contemporary Christian music really that birthed. And that was all radically new at the time, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was. And it really overlapped with it and kind of was born out of the whole countercultural movement. So a lot of these young people who were, you know, very gifted artistically, very talented musically, when they came to Jesus, they just took all of that energy and all that talent and just channeled it toward worshiping and really proclaiming the gospel. You know, the Christian music back in those days was more sort of gospel proclamation versus worship. You know, today most Christian music is worship based, which is fine. But back in those days, you know, you got a guitar, you wrote a song about how Jesus saved you, and you went out on the pier and you stood up and you played and sang and preached.
And why did Chuck Smith and Calvary Chapel kind of become the epicenter for seeing people come to Christ in this movement?
Well, I think with hindsight, it was basically because Chuck was open to it, and where many of the churches were not open to it. And Chuck, as you mentioned earlier, was my father-in-law. My mother-in-law, Kay, very curious person, very brilliant woman. She was fascinated with hippies. She just wanted to know why they were the way they were. So she had this sort of obsession, like, Chuck, we've got to meet these hippie kids. And so they finally met a hippie. His name was Lonnie Frisbee.
And what a great name, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Lonnie was one of those guys who just had a unique anointing upon his life. I mean, everywhere he went, he led people to Christ. He kind of looked like Jesus, and he was really, you know, happy to look like Jesus, or at least, you know, how we would think Jesus looked. And so it was through Lonnie's connection with Chuck that this evangelism explosion really began to take place, you know. So I think what a lot of people don't realize, you know, they sort of assume that, and we've heard this is kind of a myth in the Calvary Chapel movement, that sort of, you know, build it and they will come. So Chuck one day just stood up, opened a Bible, and decided to teach expositionally, and then thousands of hippies came. It didn't quite work that way. The hippies that came to Christ, they were evangelists. They would turn right around and go right back to where they were, and they would share the gospel with people, and they would bring them. So the church started filling up that way with young people.
I'm sure it was a crazy, messy, but kind of very life-giving time, and almost goes down in history as a kind of almost once in a lifetime generation kind of experience.
Yeah, and I think more than ever now, we are realizing how extraordinary those days were. You know, they really were unique, and there's still many good things happening.
And it kind of spread around the world. You know, the UK had its own kind of Jesus people movement. My parents were part of that. I can trace my own faith lineage, if you like, through to that. So it's had all kinds of effects around the world.
Yeah, and as I've traveled, and you know, whether it's here or, you know, Australia, South Africa, there's always a group of people that will say, yeah, at that time, this is what was happening here.
I mean, we'll talk about Chuck, obviously, more in the course of today's program, because that's an important part of your story. But coming back to you, and you were kind of not that enthusiastic about this whole hippie Jesus freaks kind of culture. Yeah. So what finally managed to get you across the threshold
of
the church?
You know, actually what happened is that the hippie thing sort of passed.
Okay.
You know, so the time kind of came and went, and now there was still a lot going on, but the hippies were now just sort of a thing of the past. And I was still just a lost young guy with a massive hole in my heart, you know, empty, and kind of just trying to figure out life, wondering what is really the purpose of life. And the Lord just began, again, with hindsight, I didn't realize it at the time, but God, by the Spirit, was just working on me personally. And I was coming under conviction. I just knew the life that I was living. Nobody was preaching to me necessarily. I just knew that this life was unacceptable to God. And I just kind of had this idea that, you know, somehow there must be a God, and I need to find out who that God is. Because, you know, at the ripe age of, you know, 19, 20 years old, I was fairly disillusioned with life already.
Already? Yeah. The lifestyle was not all it was cracked up to be.
Exactly, You know, I was, you know, like we mentioned, surfing. I actually did music. I played in some bands, played in Hollywood, had friends that went on to get record contracts and things. And so I thought that was the way to go. But, you know how it is. Everything you strive for, you think, this is going to be the thing. Mm. Oh, you know, I get this, then I am going to be happy and fulfilled and complete. And it didn't happen.
And that's maybe even more the case in a place like LA, which is kind of filled with people looking for this or that's next, you know, big thing and the solution to life and everything else.
Yeah. And I lived in sort of, you know, the suburbs of LA. Orange County is a separate county, but all of my friends and I, we gravitated toward Hollywood. So we used to go to the clubs in Hollywood. We'd go see the bands. We'd go dance. You know, we'd do all of the Hollywood stuff. My cousin said to me one time, because he asked me what I wanted to do, and it was always like, you know, I'm a movie star, rock star, you know, something like that. He said, well, how about like, what about like being like a plumber or something? You know, I said, oh, no, my friends and I.
No one's a plumber in LA. No, they're all rock stars and movie stars.
That's exactly,
Or at least they're waitresses waiting to be,
yeah,
an actress or whatever. It's yeah. So that was kind of what eventually brought you into deciding. Yeah, I'm going to check out this.
So for me, it was really kind of a process of elimination with the Spirit Himself really bringing me along. And you know, I had a series of supernatural kinds of experiences where one of them was a dream that just literally rocked my world. To the point that when I woke up, I couldn't believe it was a dream. It
Tell
was
us about so this real. Dream.
Well, it was a dream that Jesus returned. And all I knew is that I was not ready for that event. And so, you know, it was quite frightening, really. What I found out later is a lot of the details of the dream are biblical details that I didn't know anything about at the time. So later, reading the Bible and reading passages like, say, in the book of Revelation, I thought, wow, this is describing that scene that I saw in my dream. So it was that dream that really got me to seriously begin to consider what was happening in my own life. And then I had a friend who he and his band had just signed a record deal up in LA, and he was suicidal. And so he was talking to me and, you know, yeah, we just signed this record deal, but I kind of feel like killing myself. And I said to him, I said, you know, don't do that. And even though I wasn't actually saved looking back, I started sharing the gospel with him as much as I knew it. Because I just knew at that point that God was the answer. Whatever that meant exactly, I wasn't totally sure, but I knew that, you know, God was the answer. So his parents had been... They were Catholics who had become charismatic Catholics. They had moved out of the area to Arizona, and I knew his parents well. And I said to him, I said, you know what? Go see your parents. They can help you. So sure enough, he went to visit his parents, and he became a Christian.
Wow.
And he became born again.
Wow.
That was the term. And so he called me from Arizona, and he said, you're right. And, you know, that was everything you told me was true. And I'm born again. And so when did you get born again? And I thought, oh, when did I get born again? I don't know if I'm born again. And I was on the phone with him. I said, hold on. I dropped the phone. I said, Jesus, I want to be born again. And I said, yeah, I'm born again. Let's go. So that was the beginning, really. You know, that was literally like my crossing over the threshold, you know, into a real active faith at that point. Yeah.
So you got involved with Calvary Chapel.
I got involved with Calvary. Yeah, I had gone there actually a few times previously over the years. You know, it was a place with tons and tons of young people and, quite frankly, lots of cute girls. So I thought, I'll go see if I can find a nice Christian girl over there. You know, that never really worked out because I wasn't a Christian. But I just sort of knew intuitively once I did become a Christian, I knew that I needed to know the Bible, and I knew that they taught the Bible at Calvary Chapel. So that was my draw there.
That has been a long time distinctive of Calvary Chapel, the kind of very expositional Bible teaching, which you might say, well, that's not the typical way a church attracts people by, you know, doing kind of in-depth Bible teaching. You know, you do the seeker-sensitive thing. You do the kind of, you know, this is how God can help you in your workplace life or something like that. But that's kind of just been what Chuck felt drawn to do and what has continued to be the distinctive of Calvary.
Yeah, and you know, ironically, Chuck's greatest influence were all, you know, British preachers from previous generations. Right. You know, G. Campbell Morgan was his favorite Bible expositor. Yeah. Of course, he turned me on to Spurgeon and to Campbell Morgan and to Lloyd-Jones and, you know, all of those great British voices from the past. So we sort of modeled our ministry after their preaching.
Great, fantastic. So you got involved, and it was really quite early on, I guess, that you met Cheryl through...
Yeah, fairly early on, yeah. So I just, you know, once I made that commitment, I just jumped in with both feet, you know. So I started to go to church all the time. It was the church was kind of like a 24/7. You could show up anytime if something was going on. So I would go to work during the day, and I'd come and attend the Bible studies in the different groups in the evening. And... it was actually New Year's Day of 1980. So it was about a year later. Some friends of mine and I, we were just hanging around, nothing to do on New Year's Day. Everything kind of closes down early. And somebody said, oh, I wish we had a Bible study we could go to. And somebody else said, hey, I think I know where there's a Bible study happening tonight. Even though it's New Year's Day, they're probably still doing it. And sure enough, we went. It was in the home of some young people. And we went, there were a house full of, you know, young people, and it was great. And lo and behold, there was this really pretty girl there. And I thought, oh my, I wonder who she is. So, you know,
turned out to be the head pastor's daughter.
Yeah, so I continued to attend the Bible study for a few weeks to meet her. But here's the funny thing. My friend, my best friend, was sort of like, Chuck was like, you know, in a good sense, Chuck was his idol. So yes. Everything about Chuck Smith, he just absolutely loved. So he tells me, he says, Chuck Smith's daughter's at this Bible study. And I was like, well, okay, I don't know who Chuck Smith's daughter is. But I met this other girl, and she's really nice, you know, so chatting with her. So 2 weeks later, we're there again, and I'm talking to Cheryl, and I still have no idea who she is. And so my friend and I, as we're leaving, he says, so you met Chuck's daughter? And I said, no, I didn't meet Chuck's daughter. He goes, you were talking to her. And I said, oh, my gosh, what? He says, that's Chuck's daughter. So she kept that secret from me.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But yes, so that's how we met.
There you go. And the rest, as they say, is history. I mean, we'll come back to that, because obviously your story intersects with Chuck on many different levels. But you got into, I guess, you sensed a call fairly early on to lead church leadership
Yeah, I didn't know what that looked like, but I was, you know, it was one of those things. I was kind of a leader just naturally as it went. You know, I had, you know, groups of friends that I hung out with, and I was usually the person saying, hey, let's do this, or let's don't do that, or yeah, that's a good idea, or that's a bad idea. So when I came to Christ, it was like the Lord kind of took that leadership gifting and just put it in a new context, in the context of, you know, Christian leadership. So early on, I, first thing I did is I just started a Bible study in my apartment. And we started praying for friends that didn't know Christ. And within about 3 or 4 months, we had about 50 people there crammed into our little apartment who had come to faith. So we just targeted people.
Yeah,
we
said,
okay, there's so-and-so, let's pray for them. You know, we pray for them for a week, then we go evangelize them, and then they would come to faith. So so started doing things like that. But I can't say, you know, people ask me how I got into pastoral ministry. I didn't pursue it in one sense because I didn't feel like it was even a remote possibility. The only, so my history was Catholicism, right? So you got the Pope, you got the priest, and then you got Chuck Smith. And he's the only pastor I ever knew. So I'm not thinking like, you know, I can be a pastor. So that I was more of an evangelist. I just thought, if I can share the gospel with people. I was managing a surf shop at the time in Huntington Beach, California, and I just spent my days, you know, trying to sell surfboards, I guess, but I was really more trying to share the gospel with people.
And, I mean, that did eventually lead to you pastoring a church
in
Southern California, and in the end, actually traveling in a missionary capacity to Eastern Europe as well. Tell us sort of some of those sorts of adventures that you went on in the, in the 80s and early 90s.
Those were some great adventures, So what ended up happening, I was working at that surf shop, as I mentioned. Chuck knew, just from conversation, that I had a desire to serve the Lord. And so he had an idea that I didn't have. He contacted me one day at the surf shop and said, hey, I want you to pray about coming and working here at the church. And I just said, hey, well, what would I do? I don't know what to do. He said, well, I want to train you, and let's see. Let's give it some time and see. You know, maybe you're cut out for this, maybe you're not. So anyway, after a little bit of prayer, I decided to go. So I was there with Chuck and did an internship for 3 years. And at the end of 3 years, I launched out and began to pastor my own church in the northern part of San Diego County. And so I was there, and during that time, it was the late 80s, you know, everything in Eastern Europe was beginning to change. The Soviet Union was transitioning out of its situation there. And I went on a trip, and I met a young couple from what was then Yugoslavia. They found out I was a pastor. They said, could you come to our village and see if God maybe wants to do something there? So I didn't. It sounded like a good idea to me at the time. So I decided to go. We went. To make a long story short, we ended up preaching on the streets of what is now Serbia. And we led a handful of kids to the Lord. We crossed the border into Hungary. We did the same thing. And I realized, you know, we can't just lead these kids to Christ and then move on. We're going to have to disciple them. So I told them, hey, just hold tight. I'm going to go back home, and we're going to send somebody to help you. So we did two church plants unintentionally simply because we led these kids to the Lord.
Wow.
We had to have something to follow up.
That is the way churches get planted sometimes. Yeah. It's just. Yeah.
And so to fast forward, earlier this year, I was in Budapest. And there, after all these years, we transitioned the Budapest church. There's about 40 churches in Hungary now. We transitioned the Budapest church to all Hungarian leadership.
Wow.
So it was an amazing journey, you know, with that.
It's amazing the small seeds from which these things grow.
Yeah.
And that's been a story repeated in lots of parts of the world and across the USA, obviously, as individuals have taken it, you know, have been felt led to begin a Calvary Chapel and so on. And of course, what I want to come to is talking about your UK stint as well.
Yes.
And we'll do that in the next part of today's program, because you did spend a number of years here in London, and were able to continue to bless the UK with the Creation Fest as well.
Yeah.
And so we'll talk about that. And we'll talk, of course, about the challenges as well of stepping into some very big shoes in the form of Chuck Smith, and so I'm sure we'll be good to hear about that as well. You're listening to The Profile with me, Justin Briley, interviewing Brian Brodersen today. As we've been saying, Brian, senior pastor of Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa in California, the church which really launched the Calvary Chapel network of churches across the USA and the world. We're going to continue to talk about his story here on the show. And don't forget, you can find this as a podcast wherever you get your podcast from, or online at premierchristianradio.com/theprofile.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue,
we speak with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, about praying in tongues, his vision for evangelism, and how he intends to hold the Anglican Communion together. And we ask, should Christians adopt the tidying up trend of Marie Kondo? Plus, discover why we must get better at handling God's gift of prophecy. All this and more in March's issue.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's program. I'm Justin Briley, and I'm joined on The Profile today by Brian Brodersen, senior pastor of Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa in California. He's the son-in-law of Chuck Smith, who founded the Calvary Chapel Network, passed away several years ago now. And since then, Brian has been leading the Costa Mesa Church in California. We've heard about Brian's own conversion, about the history of Calvary Chapel and the Jesus People movement it was part of in the 60s and 70s. And of course, Brian continues to broadcast a daily Bible teaching program, Back to Basics. You can hear it here on Premier Christian Radio and in many other parts of the world and online. We're going to be talking a little more about what it meant to step into the shoes of Chuck, obviously, such a big set of shoes to fill. And some of the challenges that's involved, obviously, in the transition phase since then, Brian. But we kind of had got to the part in the story where you'd been in Europe, lots of interesting things happening. What led you to want to come to London specifically in the mid-90s?
Yeah. That's a great question. And so I from about 1990 is when we launched into Eastern Europe. And, I had a number of invitations to come and just do a little bit of ministry here in the UK over the years. Good friend of mine, Malcolm Wilde, Alwyn Wall, maybe those names go back in the archives, British.
These were, in a sense, the pioneers of that kind of folk Christian music scene that was all part of the Jesus People movement.
Yeah, so we were good friends. Malcolm and I were on staff together at Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa. So Malcolm was taking trips over, he was coming and doing ministry here. And I had an invitation a few times to come, and I just didn't really feel, that it was anything that I was to do at the time. I suddenly just got a sense like I should go to the UK. And we had, I think, five churches in the country at the time that were, connected, loosely connected with Calvary Chapel. So I sent out some letters and just said, hey, thinking about coming over, bringing a handful of people. Is there anything we could do? Come alongside your church, help out. And didn't really get much of a response for a few months. Then finally I got a response from one of the local pastors, and it was an interesting thing. His office had caught on fire and all that stuff. Everything had burned up. And in the rubble, they found my letter a few months later. Okay. Explained why nobody responded. And he read it, and then he immediately contacted me and he said, yeah, I think you should come. It would be nice. And I had no plan at the time to do anything other than it was more like a kind of an exploration trip. Yeah. You know, just come over and explore. See, you know, we've been doing stuff in other parts of Europe. Yeah. See if there's something here. So we came, and believe it or not, Justin, I didn't even come to London except I drove through London, and driving through, I sensed the Lord speak to me and say, I want you to start a church here. Now, for me, though, that didn't mean start a church like I'm going to move here and start a church, because what I was doing is I was supporting church planters.
Yeah.
I had a great church in Southern California. We had good resources. So we were sending people out and then, you know, supporting these church plants. So in my mind, that's what that meant.
Sure.
Okay. So anyway, at the end, we went up to the north and we did some things. And when it was all said and done, I said to a couple of my friends here in the local area, I said, I feel like the Lord wants us to start a church in London. And they laughed at me. They said, it's impossible. You can't start a church in London. You can't find a building in London. And I said, oh, okay. I didn't realize that. But anyway, this is what I believe the Lord, you know, has spoken to me. So to make a long story short, through a series of different things, we were able to get a school, and we were able to do an outreach. So we did a 6-week, I came over for 6 weeks and just did street ministry and places like Leicester Square, went into schools, Christian unions, and so forth. We did that. And then just we launched a little church plant. And at the time, I was still pretty much looking for the person who was going to do this. Mm. And at the same time, God was beginning to stir my own heart. And so it was while I was here in London. I was staying in South London at the time. I was staying at Streatham Hill. And I woke up one morning about 3 or 4 in the morning, and I just had this sense that God was saying, I want you to come here. And I was not really having that. You know,
that wasn't part of the plan.
It wasn't part of the plan. I said, Lord, look, we got a great thing going back home. Yeah. And let's just find somebody else. But it just wouldn't go away, you know. And I got up early that morning. I went downstairs. I was in the kitchen. And the next thing you know, my wife shows up there. My wife has a real prophetic sort of a gift. And so she comes down. She says, what are you doing? Why are you awake? And I said, I just can't sleep. And she just blurts it out. She goes, the Lord's calling us to move here, isn't he? just like, well, I'm glad you said that, because, you know, I was trying to figure out how I was going to tell you that was happening. So, but then you think, oh, we're just carried away with the moment. Mm. You know, we're just excited about what we see happening. Yeah. So let's go back home. And actually, she was going to go home and I was going to stay for a few more weeks. And I said, you know, you'll go home and the excitement, maybe it'll wear off. Mm. I'll get home and then we'll be back to normal. And yet when we got back, nothing changed. You know, we really had that.
Still felt like the right thing.
Just that sense, like we were supposed to do it. So we just kind of put a fleece out and said, you know, we're going to apply for a visa. And if the Lord gets us a visa, we'll take that as, you know, his leading to go. But the funny thing was, when we came back, our church, everybody was talking. The Lord spoke to us, you're leaving. You're going, no, we're not leaving. We're not going anywhere. We're fine. We love it here, you know. But yes, in the end, the Lord was calling us. Right. Yeah. So it's 1996 that we moved over.
What were some of the challenges in planting a church effectively from scratch?
From scratch, yeah.
In London, which is not exactly the easiest mission territory to begin a new thing.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely had its challenges. And, you know, when you're starting anything from scratch, I mean, the first Sunday we had 8 people.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And you've come from with Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa, you're getting like thousands every Sunday.
Yeah.
It's quite a difference.
Yeah, yeah. I came from a church at that time. My church was about 3,000 adults. Right. So, you know, and here I am with 8 people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, here we go.
Here we go.
What are we doing? And
it must have taken you back almost to those first Bible studies.
It really did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was something really sweet about it, you know, because I had, over the years, you know, your church grows, because we started originally with about 30 people where we were and grew to 3,000 over a 10-12 year period. But then there was something that you missed.
Yeah.
You know, there was that intimacy and all that kind of just went away with the large church. So it was nice to get back and revisit that. One of the great blessings was through Premier Radio, we were able to have office space literally right across the street from where we were doing doing the church in Westminster City School. And so that helped us out tremendously, you know, to be able, because we had to set up every Sunday, tear down, take stuff up the lift, put it in the office. But, you know, they were, it was an adventure. And it had its challenges, you know, so maybe the churches now say, let's just say pretty consistently 40, 50 people, and you feel like you're getting traction, you feel like you're moving forward, and then you show up one Sunday and there's like 20 people. And you think, okay, what happened here? We're going backward. And, it, you know, it would be like that.
Yeah.
And so, and then, you know, London is such a wonderful city. But, you know, you live here. After you live here for a while, it's like, okay, who cares?
Was there a kind of, was it, is part of that kind of coming to grips with the cultural differences that obviously exist between the West Coast, you know, sort of ambiance and vibe and coming to London, which, although it's cosmopolitan, still... is essentially British and is rather different in that.
Yeah, and I definitely realized that we are, you know, two people separated by a common language. You know, I did come to realize that fairly soon. But, you know, Justin, for me, I never really had that really hard adjustment because I just felt like I just kind of fit in really well. Mm. And sometimes maybe too well. It's like, okay, maybe I need to be a little more out of the box here. So we could, as a matter of fact, at one time we were planting a church in the West Country and I was talking to a friend and I brought a friend over and he was going to be the guy. And my friend looked at me and he said, this guy's way too American. You can't send him here. He said, we need somebody like you. I said, no, somebody like me, we're all going to go to sleep here in Devon. We need somebody that's going to wake this place up. So, so although there's obviously, you know, cultural differences between the U.S. and here, I didn't struggle with that so much. I didn't feel that. I felt like I... kind of, I had always been somewhat of an Anglophile anyway, you know, so I kind of jumped right in and just loved it.
Did you ever feel frustrated, though, that the church didn't grow as quickly or as fast as you obviously saw happen back home?
Yeah. No, I didn't. I didn't. Because in those days, honestly, it was sort of the days before the big emphasis on the megachurch, you know. So even when my church grew back in California, I was as surprised as the next person. It wasn't like I had some big five-year plan to grow it.
It wasn't like there was some bar you were seeking to reach.
Yeah, and of course, knowing a little bit about the churches here in London and the size of most of the churches, I was not expecting at all like we were going to have a church of thousands of people. That thought never crossed my mind. So, it you know, by the time I left in 2000, we had about 400. And, you know, I felt that that was a pretty good, you know, for the 4 years we were there.
It was, by most standards, that would be seen as extraordinarily successful here in the UK. And obviously, it's often dependent on your point of view, if you like, as
right,
to what's.
Yeah.
So, and it continues strong today, the Calvary Chapel, Westminster.
Goes,
And was it in that time that you kind of also had the vision for Creation Fest? Or did that come a little later?
Yeah, in a sense, yes, because I lived out in Twickenham. And I remember thinking, you know, out there sort of right across the bridge from Richmond, there's these big wide open spaces. And I thought, man, it would be so great to have like a festival here, you know. And of course, I know there's a festival culture. There's festivals everywhere. So I just sort of put it out of my mind, went back to the States. And then my friend Phil Pachonis, who ended up going down to North Devon, he knew that that was something that I had in the back of my mind. So one day he said, hey, there's a place here in Woolacombe. There's a valley. I think we could do a festival right in this valley. And I said, you know what? Maybe we could. So we just went for it. And and we did a one-day event, and that was in 2002. And, you know, Phil had connections in the, you know, Christian music world and stuff. So we were able to compile a pretty good group of bands to come through. We just did an evangelistic outreach, much like the outreach I just did this past weekend in Dundee.
Right.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And that has gone from strength to strength. I was able to speak back in 2017 there, and it was great to see all the different people who turned up for it and the music and all the speakers and so on.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess it's kind of a festival kind of gives you an opportunity to reach people who might not normally come over a church who it gives you a different kind of atmosphere yeah. in which to. So what have you seen as a fruit, if you like? Because yeah. this has still primarily been supported and resourced by
yeah.
the American Calvary Chapel, although yeah. obviously a lot of people from yeah. the UK involved in making it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
What's been the vision for Creation Fest in that sense?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a free festival, and, mm. and that's intentional.
Yeah.
And it's intentional because we want people to be able to come who, you know, don't know Christ, don't know anything necessarily about the Christian faith, and who are not going to pay any amount of money to go to a Christian event. So it's like, okay, it's free, so that's one hurdle. That, and we have found that lots of non-Christians, either, you know, a family member will come because it's free, or somebody might just be driving by the showground and see, you know, free music festival and come in yeah. and actually hear the gospel and receive Christ. So you know, we present it as a music festival, Bible week, but, you know, we have a strong evangelistic mm-hmm. emphasis. So we're looking to lead people to Christ. And the
I'm
other,
sure it's been exciting to see some stories of people
yeah,
who have become
amazing
Christians.
Amazing stories, yeah, 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 amazing stories. And a lot of times, you know, it's like the atheist, you know, the
yeah,
people
yeah.
that are pretty hardcore and sort of antichrist, and then they come and they experience something that they did not expect at all. It's like, wait, no, this doesn't.
It's not what. Yeah, it goes against their expectations.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then another thing that's happened as a result of it, is sort of unintentionally, is it's gone a long ways to bring some unity to the churches mm. in Cornwall.
Yeah.
And so the churches in Cornwall are, you know, that's our base.
Mm.
And they pretty much have adopted the festival as, you know, this is their festival.
Mm. Yeah.
And over the past few years, we've seen much more internal support, even financially yeah. coming. Yeah. And ultimately, we'd like to be free from the yeah. the U.S., part of it, because
yeah,
we've
sure.
done it for so many
yeah, yeah,
years, you
yeah.
know. Yeah. And you do sort of feel like, yeah, there needs to be an ownership yeah, here, yeah. you know, in the country itself.
Well, it's very easy to find it. If you're looking for Creation Fest, just go online and type in Creation Fest, you'll find that. And also Calvary Chapel. But the kind of the most significant thing probably in the last few years with Calvary Chapel has obviously been with Chuck passing away.
Yeah.
That was always going to be a difficult act to follow. Was there any sense in which you were sort of inevitably bound to step into Chuck's place? What was the process for yeah. for kind of you heading up certainly mm-hmm. the Costa Mesa church?
Yeah, there had been conversations about that actually for decades with Chuck. And one of the things that just sort of, you know, threw a spanner in the works was when I came to England, because
yeah.
Chuck was trying to get me to come to work with him in Costa Mesa, and I was open to that, but mm. my wife was not.
Right.
She did not want to go. We had come from there, mm. gone down mm. to further in Southern California. She didn't really want to go back, and then suddenly we're going to England, and Chuck's looking mm. at us like, wait, this isn't part of the plan. And I'm like, I know, I didn't think this was part of the plan either, but we're going nevertheless. So we had had conversations about it, and we had even sort of made some attempts to move in that direction, mm. but it was premature.
Mm.
And I had said to Chuck at one point, I said, look, because he kept asking me, you know, come up, I want to train you. I said, look, you know, the best training I could ever get is just keep doing what I'm doing, because mm. that's what I'm going to do when I come there, mm. right? I'm going to mm. pastor mm. and teach and preach and so forth.
Mm.
So we came to that understanding. And then what happened, you know, I was here from 96 to 2000. And Chuck, even during the 4 years I was here, he would occasionally contact me and say, you know, you need to come back. And I could sense that most of the time it was because I had taken his daughter and his four grandkids hostage to London.
Very inconvenient place to take your extended
yes.
family. Yeah.
So, you know, I could sense that it was more driven yeah. by that. And
yeah.
I just thought, you know, I can't,
yeah.
I can't do that.
Mm.
But there did finally come a point where I actually felt, it, you know, and I'll tell you real quickly, mm. I was, you know, here in London doing everything I was doing with the church, you know, having a bigger vision than just what I was doing with the church here in Westminster. And I really sense the Lord say to me, the way to fulfill the vision you have is to go back, because the resources are there that you don't have here,
mm.
and so I really sensed at that yeah. point, and then I sensed that Chuck genuinely did need help.
Yeah.
It was no
yeah.
longer just
yeah.
I want the family
yeah.
back. It
yeah.
was like he needed help. Yeah. So in 2000, I went back, and we had the plan to do a 2 to 3 year transition.
Mm.
He was going to, you know, retire.
Mm. Yeah.
Whatever that would look like, go speak at churches, mm. teach mm. at Bible college, and so forth. But that stretched out to 13 years.
Never which, quite happened.
Which had its challenges, sure. You know, for sure. And then of course, you know, Chuck contracted lung cancer and passed away in October 3rd, 2013.
Yeah. And in a sense, obviously, once the grieving and the celebrating of his life had been done,
yeah,
it left the question, you know, what were you going to be? Chuck Mark II?
Yeah.
But no one can be Chuck. No. Chuck was an individual, yeah. Unique.
Yeah.
And kind of what he established was unique.
Yeah.
And so that always kind of leaves a big issue for, yeah. for someone who's then stepping in to something, a work established by someone else, yeah, yeah, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
I'm sure that was quite challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd read enough history, church history, to know that these things generally don't go that well.
Yeah.
You know, because mm-hmm. Chuck was, he was like a legend in his own yeah, lifetime. Yeah. You know, I mean, he'll go down in history like a Charles Spurgeon or yeah, someone like yeah. that. And when you look at the guy that immediately followed Spurgeon mm-hmm. or the guy that immediately followed Lloyd Jones, most people don't even
you're
know
like,
who they were.
Who's that?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think the advantage I had, Justin, is that I was confident that God was calling me to do it, mm. not that Chuck was calling me to do it. And as a matter of fact, I was very confident that Chuck would not make me the pastor of the church, and he did not. I was confident that the mm. Lord would. So when he passed away, he left no instruction like, okay, make Brian the pastor right. of the church. It was the decision of the church board, and so they decided.
There have been some issues, obviously, and yeah. in 2017, Christianity Today actually published an article titled A Tale of Two Calvary Chapels Behind the Movement Split. That's the way it's been painted.
Yeah.
Do you want to give us your take on what's happened to the Calvary Chapel yeah. network, which I believe now exists in sort of two bodies, essentially?
Yeah, yeah. So the Calvary Global Network, that's kind of the new thing that I'm leading. And then there's the Calvary Chapel Association. And I think honestly, a split is probably too strong of a word okay. because there are plenty of churches who are connected to both bodies.
Okay.
And my intention is to just say, that's fine. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not asking anybody to exclusively follow me. You know, for me, it was really more of, I think, just vision and looking at the future, where I felt like the group of guys that I was connected with, you know, personally, I felt that they were sort of stuck in the past and wanting to.
And that's always the danger when you've had something like Calvary yes. Chapel, where which has seen such amazing things yeah. happen in the past. You can yeah. sometimes end up looking back to the past. We've got to
yeah.
keep doing it the way we yeah. did it then.
We've got to perpetuate what yeah. we've had. And of course, you know, this group of guys, they have their interpretation of Chuck sure. and who he was and what he wanted to do. And I have my interpretation of Chuck. I think I was a little closer to him
yeah.
than all of them. Not only, you know, his son-in-law for 30 plus years, but I worked alongside of him, you know, for many years as well. So, and you know, Chuck was a guy who I think when it's all said and done, you recognize he was a guy who tried to be sensitive to what the Spirit was doing and not be so bothered by what everybody else was saying, but just go, I think the Lord's telling us to go in this direction. And honestly, that you know, that's what I want to do. When I left the U.S. and came to the U.K., that was huge because in the Calvary Chapel family of churches, the way it always went was you started your church, you established it, and basically you stayed there the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, I'm kind of breaking the mold by going, okay, hey, adios. You know, I'm leaving. Yeah. They're saying, wait, you can't do that. Mm. Okay, well, I feel like. So it seems like it's been that type of thing where the Lord is calling me to sort of step out of the boat, so to speak. You know, I want to do something fresh. So Calvary Chapel, the that one version of it, to me, its destiny is a denomination. Now, yeah. denominations aren't bad, but I just think that at this time in history, why start another denomination where you have to just constantly be worried about your brand and you have to protect your brand and all of that? As you know from us doing stuff together, even at Creation Fest, we work with all different kinds of church groups and Christians, and that's kind of the vision that God's given me.
It must have been challenging, though, because inevitably these things can get acrimonious. And
oh, yes.
there are such things as internet message boards where people can post things and say things.
Yes.
And it kind of can get hurtful, I'm sure.
Yeah,
so how did you deal with that? Because any kind of a split, even when you're trying to do it in the most Christ-like way possible,
yeah.
inevitably people say things and do things.
Yeah, they do. And there has been so much misinformation out there. You know, I mean, all the time. I had one person, I think he summed it up best. He looked at me one day and he said, you know, I've never met you, but what I've concluded from everything I've read is that you are either the devil himself or you're a really godly guy. And I said, well, I hope it's the latter that you have concluded. So yeah, there's been some acrimony out there for sure. And again, I think for me, it just goes back to the conviction that I have that, you know, this is what God's called me mm-hmm. to do. So I have tried to just, I think I've tried to be a peacemaker and I've tried to just say, okay, look, I get it. I understand that you guys don't really like what I'm doing, but I'm just, this is what I think the Lord wants mm-hmm. me to do. So I'm going to move forward. And the stuff that's out there on the internet, 99.9% of it isn't true. Mm-hmm. So I don't let it bother me.
Well, it's good that you can have the kind of broad shoulders that allow that to happen. I mean, in terms of you taking forward Calvary Chapel yeah. in the way that you have now kind of organized the global network, what are your hopes? What are you trying to do that's different from perhaps what has mm-hmm. been the past story of Calvary?
Yeah. Well, I like the idea of a network. Mm. So the association is a much tighter, mm-hmm. Much narrower kind mm-hmm. of a connection. And I want to have a bit of a broader connection. So the global network is basically two things. For Calvary Chapel guys, it is doctrinally Calvary Chapel. Mm-hmm. So they feel comfortable. Mm. For non-Calvary Chapel guys, it's basically broadly evangelical mm-hmm. doctrinally. So they can feel comfortable without feeling any pressure to become Calvary Chapel. Mm. So if you're pastoring a Baptist church somewhere, but you like the vision, then come on board mm. and be part of the network. Mm. You know, if you're pastoring an Anglican mm. church or whatever the case, if you like the vision, you can be part of it. Nobody's going to ask you to put up a Calvary mm. Chapel sign mm. or to change your name or do anything like that. So I feel like it's just in keeping with the broader vision that mm. God's given me for an evangelical kind of an ecumenical thing. Now, some people mm. see that as a bad thing,
yeah.
evangelical, ecumenical mm. type of a thing. Mm. I see it as a good thing.
Yeah.
I think in these days, we need to rally around the essentials of the faith and stop squabbling yeah. over non-essential things.
And in your local incarnation now, back in Costa Mesa, yeah. How do you kind of do in today's world what Chuck was doing back in the 60s and 70s of reaching people where they are?
Yeah.
In what are some of the things you're trying to put in place to kind of mm-hmm. see that vision realized for today?
Well, you know, we have a strong emphasis on evangelism still, but we're also, we just want people to understand that the doors are wide open,
yeah.
whoever you are, wherever you're coming from. Mm. That's the way it's always been.
Yeah.
So you're welcome. Mm. Come in, listen to what we're saying. We have a strong biblical standard, but we're going to give space for people to, you know, figure things out. And you know, I'm quite happy with yeah. the way things are yeah. currently going.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you still get a chance to get down on the beach and do a bit of surfing?
You know, it's so bad. I have gotten to the point where I've been surfing maybe once or twice a year, which is just terrible. It's absolutely terrible. So
you do yourself an injury if you don't, you know,
yes.
keep in shape with it, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So this year before Creation Fest, I decided, okay, I'm going to jump out in the water, get a few, because, you know, we go to Creation Fest and everybody surfs down there and yeah. they're asking me about surfing. So I can't be a hypocrite. I got to say, yes, I surfed last week. So I surfed a few times before the fest. I surfed a few times after it. And I'm trying to discipline myself to surf once a week. If I could just surf once a week, I would accomplish much.
Wow. Thank you so much for the time today, Brian.
You're welcome.
I know that from the bio that I saw online from you, that your favorite verse, 2 Corinthians 12:9-10, and he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest mm-hmm. upon me. I suppose that's in some ways sums up a lot of what we've been talking about, that through it all, Christ does his work through normal people, broken people very often.
Yeah.
Nothing's necessarily easy.
Right.
But God works in the mess.
He does, yeah.
And will continue to do so.
Yeah.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
You've been listening to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley, interviewing Brian Brodersen from Calvary Chapel. And if you want more about them, do look them up online. And indeed, look up Creation Fest as well. Certainly, if you're in the West Country or in that neck of the woods, they do a fantastic festival every year. You can find out more about the profile if you go online, look for our podcast, or go to premierchristianradio.com/the profile. And don't forget to subscribe to Premier Christianity magazine for more interviews with Christians in all walks of life and faith. You can get a free sample copy of the latest edition at premierchristianity.com/free sample. Thanks for being with me on today's show. We'll be back with another guest next week. For now, it's time to hand over to hear some of the best bits from the past week here on Premier Christian Radio.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Cunahan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.